Art Graves. Thank you, Art.
All right, thanks. Sorry, it's not letting me share my screen. Someone else has shared their screen.
Looks like Steve Drahota is sharing his screen.
Yeah, Steve, I think you had the presentation up, but now we see your background. If you could go and bring that back up again.
This is Hillary. I believe Art has a couple slides to share before Steve can present.
Right. So if Steve can stop screen sharing, that would be ideal. Thanks.
Okay. So can everyone see that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So but that's for South Park Blocks. Art is course, the one you pulled up.
Of course it is.
Good point.
Whoever wants to stay on Steve's beautiful view of the city, I think, you know, whatever city that is, I want to go to there right now.
Sydney before the fires. So there we dream.
Sorry about that. So just to kind of jump into it. So the Burnside Bridge Earthquake Readiness Project, and this has come before you a couple times before, both commissions. So quickly, the background, Burnside Bridge, it was built in 1924 through 26. It's a Basque bridge. Approximate length is 1,400 feet long and essentially 75 feet wide. It's an individually listed nationally registered landmark that was done in 2012. And its common name is Bridge 511. Zoning, it spans a few different zones. So it's in the Central City Plan District. Base zones, it's CX, OS, IG1, and EX, depending on kind of where you are and where it touches down. Number of overlays, a design overlay, obviously a historic overlay because it's a landmark. Two greenway overlays, one is the lowercase g River General, and one is the lowercase r, the River Recreational. And then it has a scenic resource overlay as well. I just wanted to kind of prep this conversation today. The briefing is about the bridge, but it really hones in on the preferred option that the community task force put forward, and that's the long span option. You've already seen this, but it's a really helpful kind of set of images that give you a lot of information on that. And it also kind of speaks to kind of the big design issues, which it really puts in motion, which are, you know, this might be oversimplifying it, and Steve can definitely kind of jump in later and polish this, but it's really putting kind of the structural onus on the top of the bridge rather than on the bottom of the bridge. So it allows fewer columns below, but kind of greater structure above.
Art, could you make this full screen, please?
Sorry about that.
No worries.
And again, Zara, this was sent to you before, so hopefully you have this in a kind of size that you can kind of look at. The other thing I just wanted to mention is that this is in the Central City 2035 plan, or rather, some of the impacts of the long span option, primary impacts of the the structure being above the bridge rather than below is its impact on views. And there's a lot of information on the sheet, obviously, but if you focus in on, there is a designation for the White Stag building, or the White Stag's, and that's called out in the Central City 2035 plan. Issues that I think would be good to cover and kind of tease out is just the removal of the existing bridge if the long span option does ultimately move forward. Comments on the long span option in and of itself, the pluses and minuses. Another thing is the community task force was not in support of the temporary bridge. And so I'd like both commissions' feelings on that, if they have strong opinions. And then the proposed mitigation for the bridge removal, Landmarks Commission in particular has touched on that consistently. What are the mitigation? And so I think it'd be good to revisit that. And I also think it would be good just for both hearing bodies to hear about the impacts that this bridge option will or will not have on other resources, particularly the surrounding landmarks and historic districts that are around the site. And this image is just kind of coincidental, but I think it does kind of speak to the both the Burnside Bridge and the view of that sign and how they kind of resonate, and you see that pop up a lot. So just kind of leave you with that if you have any questions.
Great. And we can hear from the project team now. Please do start with your name and maybe just a mailing address for, you know, for the primary person.
Okay, great. Well, just before I begin, Teresa, did you want to say a few words before we get started? Not sure if I'm hearing anything. Okay. Okay, well, our Multnomah County's address, 1403 Southeast Water Avenue, 97214, I believe. Okay. Well, thank you everyone for making time for us today. I also saw that magazine cover and I just thought, wow, of all things. So Art, thank you for bringing that up. I'm certainly saving that copy. Today I have with me several folks from our project team to present to you today. We have I'm Megan Neal. I'm with Multnomah County Transportation. I am the project manager for the project, and then with me I have Steve Drahota from HDR. He's our technical team lead, and I have Jeff Heilman from Parametrics. He's our NEPA lead. We've came to these commissions, I believe, last fall, so we're eager to come back to you and share some new results we have today, provide a general project status update, and then, as Art mentioned, share with you the recommendations that came out of our most recent community task force meeting regarding the recommended alternative, as well as what to do with traffic during construction. So on the next slide, I just wanted to remind the group, why are we doing this project? And I'll just wait for the screen to advance. It might, I don't know if it's frozen on my end.
So hopefully it's advancing. I'm seeing it advancing on my screen, Megan.
Okay.
No.
No advancement?
No.
Not seeing that.
No.
Okay. Let me try something else. Apologize for this.
Well, I can keep talking.
Is it in presentation mode?
It is now. So how about that, Megan? You seeing any difference?
No.
No.
Could you just click on the slides to the left?
Sure.
To advance.
Any difference?
No.
It's unfortunate. It's working perfectly on my screen.
It might be that you're sharing the program, not the screen. What do you share your screen?
Okay, let me try that one more time then.
Maybe unshare and reshare?
I need to get back to the starting place and...
Still frozen. Same.
Yeah, at this point, my Zoom doesn't seem to be behaving the way I want it to.
Does anybody else have this presentation that they could share it from their screen in advance for whoever's speaking?
Yeah, I could try to share. Maybe Steve unshare and I could put on.
Yeah, all right. There we go.
Okay.
Apologize, everybody.
That's life these days.
All right, so if I go view presentation mode.
I can see your screen just fine.
Megan. Okay. How do I go into presentation mode, or should I just go like that? Did it advance for everybody?
Yep.
Okay, we'll just go with that. Okay. I will multitask. Okay. All right, well, I just wanted to remind the group, why are we doing this big mega project? And ultimately, the county feels it's really important to create a seismically resilient Burnside Street bridge in downtown Portland across the Willamette River. We want it to be fully operational and accessible for all modes after a major earthquake. And as you may already be aware, many of our downtown bridges are highly vulnerable to a major earthquake and would not survive if we had it today. These bridges could be out for months, years, so it's really important to have at least one bridge that the region can rely on after this pending disaster. Ultimately, we want this project to create a bridge that supports our region's ability to provide fast, reliable emergency response, rescue and evacuation after the big one. We want a bridge to help connect the city to enable that critical post-earthquake economic recovery that will help our region get back on its feet. And then in general, the bridge is 94 years old. It's crumbling. We need it to last another 100 years. So we're also looking for a long-term low maintenance bridge that it can serve all our users safely for another 100 years. So as I mentioned, we came back to this, we were at this group in September. So I just wanted to provide a brief snapshot of our overall project schedule. We are currently halfway through the environmental review phase. And just a reminder, we are conducting this project under the recent executive order called One Federal Decision, which effectively says that all NEPA processes must be conducted in 2 years. So we're a little bit on an accelerated schedule situation. So because of that, we are starting some early work in light blue that you would normally see in the design phase. Two pieces to that work. The first piece is early permitting assistance with the city. Because we have to fast track our federal permits, it makes sense to also get started on the coordination process with the city. We are also starting a bridge type selection study to really determine what structure type that is best for the project, both from the movable span perspective as well as the fixed spans. And that's why you heard Art talk about, well, now the structure could be above the deck versus now it's below the deck. So we're starting that work now, mainly because of the Coast Guard permit that is required as part of that accelerated federal permitting timeline. So we plan to formally, though, start the design phase in January of 2022. We anticipate that lasting about 2 to 3 years, and we hope to start construction in July of 2024. And that would be, you know, not knowing exactly what we're going to build, we're saying right now it's about a 5-year construction phase timeline. So we are funded through the design phase through the county's recently raised vehicle registration fee. Last fall, we raised it by $37 per year per vehicle specifically for this project. That, however, does not get us all the way there. So for construction phase dollars, we are continuing to pursue all avenues. For example, we are a project that is included in Metro's upcoming Get Moving 2020 bond measure. That would secure $150 of revenue for the construction phase. So we are hoping the region's voters will say yes to that bond measure. So next, Steve is going to walk us through what the recommendations are that recently came out of our community task force meeting. And Steve, just give me a nod to advanced slides.
No problem. Hopefully I can speak better than I can actually present on this today. So before we get into that recommended alternative that was developed by the CTF, we wanted to give you some background on the range of alternatives that we looked at. So first, it was effectively the attempt at a minimize the impacts, meaning the enhanced seismic retrofit, where you would actually take the existing bridge and retrofit it, strengthen it, in some places replace, just because of the nature of constructability issues. So that was one of the first alternatives. The other three are forms of replacement. And all of the replacements, it's uncertain whether there's a bascule or a lift movable span. And you're seeing in the second slide where it says short span, a lift span. And this is one where the columns are placed somewhat consistent with where they are today, maybe adjusted a little bit, but generally speaking, around the same span lengths as today. And with the structure type, the bridge type itself being underneath the deck, as opposed to a long span, which is the next one, which is primarily above, and Art mentioned that. The reason for this long span is because it spans, well, as the name says, much further, and you need that structural capacity embedded above the deck, not below, because of vertical clearances, whether it's over the river, over the parks, over the freeway, or over the railroad. So these long span options, and this represents a family of options, and we'll get into some of those as depicted on the fact sheet that each of you have seen so far. And this is the one that is the recommended alternative by the CTF. The last was an offshoot of the short span called the Cooch Connection, where we capitalized on the Cooch-Burnside couplet and sort of split the roadway alignment east-west into different directions. This one, for reasons I'll explain a little later, was not that recommended alternative. So next slide, please. So this, it says preferred alternative, really is recommended alternative by the Citizens Task Force, is this long span. This is an isometric view of it, and it really consists of two primary visual elements, just like Art described, the longer approach spans, and then the middle movable span. In all of these cases, it's a, call it a low profile bridge for where the deck is. So it's similar to what's out there today in terms of accessing, in terms of profile grade, of the vehicular and bike head grades. It's just where you place the superstructure and the type of superstructure to support these longer spans. And in the middle there, in the sort of inset pictures at the bottom, are two different types of movable spans. On the left is a lift bridge, similar to, well, steel bridge you can see in the background, or the existing bascule bridge, which is shown in the isometric view and is comparable to what's out there today. And this is just one variation of what it could look like. So next slide, please. And so in the fact sheet where we were trying to describe, okay, what is it, what are the options and how to consider these various types that go with this family of long span. The first is called a tight arch, and it's, well, just like it's shown on the screen, it really is kind of a bowstring truss type of structural system. And the whole point to the type selection phase is to establish, well, should it be this type of tight arch structure, or as we'll see in a follow-on slide, a cable stay bridge, or even something else. And we're not looking to solve all of the aesthetics, all of the particular issues that go with the bridge. We're trying to really get into the details that matter for permitting, the federal permits, where are the piers placed in the river? What's the scale and size of the piers in the river? What are those drivers for getting federal permits, which is now part of that one federal NEPA decision that Megan talked about earlier. The particulars, which are shown in blue, whether it's the size of the arch ribs or the cross frame shape or exactly what the cable size and pattern is, or even some of the amenities, lighting, railing, color, texture, and even the arch height. Those are all variables that, if this was selected, will be played out during that final design phase. And so this is the tight arch option. There's a comparable on the next slide, alternative called a cable stay. It's a little difficult to see the cables in this particular view. If you look to the far east side of the river, you can kind of see the cables a little bit more. So this alternative is, you know, structurally, it's again more superstructure above the deck. In this case, it's the cables. It's just a different style. It does have a different aspect and visual impact associated with the height of the towers and the cables themselves. But in and of themselves, it's another type of long span bridge. Frankly, there's others that we'll be looking at during the type selection phase. Could be a through truss, which is comparable to a Hawthorne. You know, when you think of a truss structure, it's another almost a variant to the tight arch in that you're driving through it. On the next slide is one of our other principal elements that Art was describing. It's the movable span itself. And consistent with what we're doing for those approaches, we're trying to answer the question from a type selection standpoint, should it be a lift? Should it be a bascule, meaning rotating versus a pure lift? And with it comes, again, a whole host of aesthetic ideas that can play off of whether it's a lift structure or a bascule structure. And again, those kind of questions and decisions are something that we're looking to push until the final design phase and really get into this answer of should it be, or which one of these two types should it really be. And so to help highlight all the different variables on the next slide, we've tried to gather a suite of different, we'll call it representative bridges from across the United States and some locally that carry these different aesthetic features that fall into a tight arch as is shown in the first row, or a cable stayed option as shown in the second row, or even a through truss as shown in the third row. And really not try to land on the exact look, style, feel of it, but really it's the type that we're trying to resolve. And then with the type, where are those foundations that would dictate some permitting and mitigation that has to be done? Within the movable span itself, the bottom two rows are set up where you have bascule on the fourth row. Again, different variants to what it takes to just rotate the bridge up, and some different bridges across, frankly, the world, or a vertical lift. And a vertical lift, while we have known to love the ones that we have in Portland here, there are many styles of vertical lift that could be brought in. So again, as you think about these different types, we're trying to select amongst the grid what kind of approach combined with what kind of movable, so that that combination can then be further studied into the final design phase. All right, so with that, we brought all of these, well, we brought the alternatives, the four alternatives that I started with, to the Citizens Task Force, the CTF. And through the evaluation process, we heard the following results as it related to their recommended alternative. for the replacement long span. One, it's best from a seismic resiliency standpoint because it has the fewest number of columns in this liquefiable zone, and I'll talk about that on the next slide, but it is a significant consequence. The location of this bridge is in a highly vulnerable location, as are all of the downtown movable bridges. And so as a baseline criteria of having this bridge immediately operable after the earthquake, this driving need to minimize the earthquake risk, the risk that Mother Nature doesn't behave the way we want it to, really is borne out through the locations and quantity of columns for each of the alternatives. So I'll talk about that. Second, it happened to be, and this was a bit of a surprise to us, this long span became the lowest cost of the alternatives. And in part, it's driven by the need for these large diameter foundations and some ground improvement mitigation needed everywhere those are placed. It resulted in a reduced number of columns within Waterfront Park and in and around the Burnside Skate Park, which was told to us by different agencies and by the community of a benefit to open up the space underneath. All of the replacement alternatives provide some additional deck width, and I'll actually show you that slide here in a couple slides. It really, most of the widening that comes with the replacement versus the retrofit versus the existing is placed into the bikes and ped spaces. So we'll demonstrate that in the cross section to come. Because there's fewer number of columns in the water, it results in the reduced amount of impacts for natural resources. And so that was a significant benefit to many. And the one feedback piece that caused a little bit of trepidation by the CTF is this impact on views by the long span. And so as one of the points that they gave to us is really to examine and explore ways to mitigate those views or impact views as we progress forward. So next slide, please, Megan. So this series of slides, it really tries to represent, and I don't know if you can, Megan, or not, but zoom in, maybe a touch, represent where these columns are, foundations are for each of the alternatives. And as you sort of track from the top to the next, to the next, to the next, you can see this sort of burnt orange coloring. Those represents where the columns are located. Within the orange mass that runs along either bank, that is the highly liquefiable layer of soil that exists out there. And what that means is, left unto itself, this magnitude 9 cascaded subduction zone earthquake comes. The flow is, based on our geotechnical analysis, is somewhere between 20 and 40 feet from that bank into the river on the east side, and then smaller, about 10 feet on the west side. And so as you place more and more columns into this very liquefiable lateral spread flow, technical term, you're creating vulnerabilities that you have to mitigate for, either by going in and placing ground improvement islands to strengthen the soil, or some other mechanism to hold back those columns. And so one of the natural benefits of the replacement long span is you only have one set of columns for the entire structure inside of this threatening zone, and it provided a significant benefit both to the resiliency risk, or really mitigation of that, and the cost, because you don't have to pay for all of that underground soil mitigation that every other alternative would have required you to do. So this is a meaningful impact that we found for these different alternatives. Next slide, please. I mentioned earlier fewer columns in the parks, and three out of the four pictures, the only one is the upper right, which is Burnside Skate Park, but the other three are at Waterfront Park. And there's a comparison of the number of columns. The upper left is the replacement long span for the cable stay alternative. Frankly, so this places one set of columns in or around Waterfront Park. If you have a tied arch option, those columns would actually slide closer to Naval Parkway and it would open it up even more. But either way, there's sort of one set of columns for these long span in the park itself. And then for each of the other alternatives, as you look at the bottom left corner, it's a replacement short span. And so you're adding at least one additional bent or suite of columns in. And if you pan to the right, Megan, you'll see the enhanced seismic retrofit, which really utilizes every single set of columns, and you have to strengthen and thicken every single one of those, not just above ground, but a massive amount of deep foundation system below ground. And in the upper right-hand corner is really an illustration of the view of what this replacement long span would be in or around Skate Park. We've configured the bridge itself to span all the way from east of the skate park over the top of it and land to the west of 2nd Avenue. In fact, we're looking at a potential change where it shifts these columns even further to the west. So that's some of the refinements that we'd be looking at during the type selection phase. In terms of, next slide, please. In terms of cross-section, I mentioned that the replacement bridges brings with it this added benefit of additional space for bikes and peds. And this is a cross-section comparison of the existing, which would also be the enhanced seismic retrofit, versus each of the different replacements. So all the replacement options affords the opportunity to widen the bridge out so that it goes from its current hourglass shape into more of a rectangular shape all the way across. And so the additional space that's used, generally speaking, you can see the difference between the travel lane widths by either a foot or a half a foot, is predominantly pushed out to where the bike ped space is. And so that's a significant benefit, as we've been hearing from the bicycle pedestrian community, in terms of the replacements themselves. So next slide is views from on top of the bridge. And so one of the, again, going back to the feedback from the Citizens Task Force, some element of concern or request to really explore view sheds, both on top of the bridge and around the bridge. And so we developed some 3D renderings that would simulate where the different viewpoints of the Portland, Oregon sign are, which are the top two, whether it's the arch concept on the left or the cable stay concept on the right, with a true-ish, what you call it, representation of what the member sizing would be. And then on the bottom, left and right, the arch concept and cable stay concept. If you're on the north side of the bridge, again, looking west towards the sign, which is basically right down the middle of where the sidewalk is. So we wanted to illustrate these different potential view impacts that come with these alternatives as we're getting into the studies themselves. All right, and I think the last slide for me is this question about the what happens to traffic during construction or maintenance of traffic. We investigated two different alternatives and ran traffic analyses on each. One is with a temporary bridge and the other was with the full bridge closure. The obvious benefit of having the temporary bridge is you can maintain one lane of traffic in each direction, plus bikes and peds. The downside of it is it costs $90 million in added cost to the project because during construction, you have to maintain a movable bridge, and that movable bridge comes at a very, very heavy price. And so building in this temporary bicycle pedestrian bridge added bicycle pedestrian and traffic bridge built in $90 million to the project cost. It also added about 2 years of overall construction duration to the project because you have to build all of that infrastructure within in-water work windows for the Willamette River. And so because of the costs, the extra duration, and the fact that having that bridge really only amounted to a 2 to 4 minute reduction in overall travel time during construction, the CTF recommended that that investment not be made and to go forward with reduced costs, reduced overall construction duration, and then accept a detour to some of the other sites, which is shown in red arrows on the picture. And the one final thing I'll say about this is some people, it was a surprise to us to find that it was only a 2 to 4 minute delay without a temporary bridge. And that's because with one lane in each direction, you have significant congestion, even with a temporary bridge. And so when you think about that congestion that comes with a one lane in each direction temporary bridge, that's what resulted in only a 2 to 4 minute benefit, depending on what your origin destination was. So with that, I'll hand it over to, I believe, Jeff, who will talk about some of the other project features.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah, this is Jeff Heilman with the project team. I just wanted to give a little bit of an overview about historic resources and where we're at right now with our analysis and assumption understanding about potential impacts. We're looking at three aspects from a regulatory and resource type. Section 106, National Historic Preservation Act, also Section 4F, which applies solely to U.S. Department of Transportation projects, and any resource that is a Section 106 resource is also considered Section 4F, has special federal protections because of that. And then we're also looking at local historic landmarks. Next slide, please. So this is this map shows a number of things on it. Some of these are new resources determined eligible as a result of our process, eligible for the National Register. This doesn't show all of the potential contributing or all the contributing resources within the districts. There'd be a lot of dots there on the west side if we showed all that. What I did want to run through is where we're, what we understand right now regarding impacts from the alternatives. And right up front, wanted to say that the two historic districts, the New Chinatown, Japantown, and historic district, and the National Landmark District of Skidmore, Old Town, no adverse effects on those districts have been identified. There was concern. In fact, there would have been impacts with some of the alternatives we had during the feasibility study. That there was a fixed bridge alternative, for example, a number of them that it carried the western approach started back inside the district itself. It was on structure, starting back around the park blocks, and that would have had definitely an adverse effect on the historic districts and probably no physical impacts on contributing buildings themselves, but certainly a major visual impact right within the district. The alternatives we have remaining, we have no adverse effects on the districts. The only concern we have with the districts themselves is that there are a number of buildings contributing resources, unreinforced masonry, that as best as we can tell, have not had any seismic reinforcement. So there's some concern that vibration during bridge demolition and during construction activities, is concerned that they could be affected. So, just lost our screen. So there's a concern that they could be affected during construction. We're working closely with the constructability folks, and obviously that'll be part of the direction going forward, and objectives going forward is to make sure there aren't any impacts like that. There is one building within the district that will be demolished. That's the Saturday Market Administrative Building, just on the south side of Burnside. It is not contributing to the resource, not the same period, time period as the district itself. We do have adverse effects on the Burnside Bridge itself. We also have adverse effects from a Section 106 perspective on the Burnside Skate Park that did not have any recognized historic status or designation before the project, but as part of the inventory work we did for the EIS, our historic folks identified that as significant, and they believe it is eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. Preliminarily, SHPO has informally agreed with that. We'll have to go through the formal process of having that reviewed. The next category is some properties that are historic properties that we have potential effects, we're not entirely sure yet, or it depends on the alternative. Portland Harbor Wall, our historic preservation folks believe that is eligible for the National Register. The seismic retrofit would take out about 150 feet of that and then rebuild it. The other alternatives, the long span would not, no effects from the long span. The White Stag sign also, it does not currently have National Register status of any kind, but it's a city-designated local historic landmark, and our team has determined it's also eligible for the National Register. There would be changes in views, especially with the long-span alternative because of the structure above the deck. Some views would change. Our historic team doesn't believe it's an adverse effect from a 106 perspective, but it is definitely identified as a visual impact under the visual impacts analysis. And then the last one with potential effects are any buried resources because of the underground work and the uncertainty of where pre-contact or post-contact resources exactly are. We just don't know at this time how excavation might impact some of those. We're doing some more analysis, some actual physical potholing out there that will tell us a little bit more. Actually, it'll tell us a lot more than we know now, but there's uncertainty at this point. And then other resources, I just want to identify no adverse effects on them. And these last three were all, as part of our EIS process, identified or designated as potentially eligible for the National Register. They weren't currently on it. Fire station number one that's on NATO, the Ankeny Pump Station in Waterfront Park, right on the harbor wall, and then the Union Pacific Railroad on the east side. Other parts of the Union Pacific Railroad corridor within Oregon, it's the old, what was it called? The Oregon and California line eventually became the UPRR. Other parts in other areas of Oregon, it's already on the National Register. This part was not, but they feel like it also is eligible. And that's all I had on historic resources for now. I think back to Megan at this point.
Yeah. So we just have a few more slides and then we'd love to get into discussion and question and answer period. Just wanted to share with this group that we are planning on going out to the public in August with an online open house and a myriad of briefings to share this recommended alternative and the whole idea of closing the bridge during construction to get feedback from stakeholders, interest groups, general public, elected officials. I think we've reached out, we're reaching out to 100 groups and probably half of them will take us up on their offer to brief them. So we're doing our best during COVID and so we'll just try to get the word out. Our outreach also includes a community engagement liaison program where we're conducting outreach to about 5 or 6 different ethnic groups within the region. So we're trying to have as broad as reach as possible, given that this is a regional project. And then just what to expect for the remainder of the environmental review phase. We have this timeline where we show the next few years across the top. And then we have key milestones for the environmental review phase in green. And then key overlaid on that timeline, we have key milestones for the type selection phase in blue. And I'll just highlight a couple of environmental phase milestones. In the top left in May, June, that's where we are today, where the CTF has recommended a preferred alternative. We'll be doing the outreach, as I just mentioned, in August. Then on down in January and February of 2021, we will publish our draft environmental impact statement and hold a formal public comment period. So at the beginning of the year, we'll be doing that. And then once we receive all of our comments, we will process them and work through the approval process within the region, whether it be through city council, metro council, etc., to ultimately approve the recommended alternative, which will then be published in a final environmental impact statement of October 2021, which will also have our record of decision. And then finally, just because we're under one federal decision, we have to have all of our federal permits in hand 90 days after the publication of the ROD, hence all this accelerated design work. So that's a snapshot of what to expect over the coming year or so. And then finally, I just want to leave this slide up as you guys gather your questions. These are the areas where we anticipate coordinating with these the two commissions in the future. So in this current environmental NEPA phase, I think you've heard today all the things that we plan on working through. And then we touched on the type selection phase where we'll be working through the bridge type design, urban and design guidelines, certain working groups that we're setting up to help shepherd the process through, including an urban design working group, a permitting working group, which of course will include a lot of city coordination. And then during final design, we'll be back with a type 3 and 4 design review and a type 4 demolition permit should the recommended alternative become the preferred alternative and the existing bridge is demolished. As well as further refinement of the design guidelines, facilities and treatments, and then the land use permitting process. So with that, we would love to open the floor up to questions. I'll go ahead and stop sharing my screen so we can see everyone, but we have many backup slides to share if a question pops up and we need to reference them. So I can certainly bring the presentation back up.
Thank you very much. There's a lot of information here. And as far as I know, we also do have quite a number of testifiers. I think something that I saw earlier this morning had a total of 13 testifiers, and that might have included a few duplicates. Laura, would you speak up and just let us know how many testifiers you have right now?
There's actually only one. Those are attendees. Only right. The one red is, yeah.
Okay. But, well, that makes me feel much better.
Yeah, but that
time management seen, wise.
Excuse me. That person I haven't seen check in, though, to the hearing, so we may not have any.
Okay. Then let's go ahead and start with any questions from the commissioners for the overall project. And maybe I'll go ahead and just lead off with one of them about the overall schedule. Could you let us know when to expect the Section 106 work, and then also just the NEPA and when those processes are expected to start and then end? I think that's a question for you, Jeff.
Okay, thanks. So Section 106, we started it, we initiated it. We've got the list of parties, interested parties. Historic Landmarks Commission is listed as one. We expect to have a draft programmatic agreement or perhaps an MOA for Section 106 in early 2021. And then we're hoping to have a signed programmatic agreement for 106 by summer of 2021. Finally, EIS would be published in October then of that year, 2021. And then the NEPA schedule is publish a draft EIS January of this coming year, 2021. So in about 6 months. And then, like I said, the final EIS record of decision, October of 2021.
So the project would be coming through to all of the commissions during the early start of the draft environmental impact statement release and the public comment period. So whether it's Design Commission or Landmarks, we will be doing a project-specific briefing. And then there's an opportunity for you to provide written comment, should you choose to do so, as part of the DEIS.
Thank you. Other commissioners, go ahead and... Commissioner Foti, I see you have...
Oh, I unmuted. I was just going to ask a quick question regarding the mitigations, and presumably SHPO is already involved. Have they already listed some proposed mitigations, or are you guys proposing them, or at what point does that come up and get resolved? And
yeah, good question. So we've started proposing some potential mitigation measures, nothing that's really been talked about very much yet. Mostly we had the historic resources team and archaeological team identify their first cut at ideas. Those were in a cultural resources technical report that went out for initial review in the winter. That one might have been around March or April, can't recall. We've got comments back. from the city, not too many from SHPO yet. I think SHPO probably isn't going to really give us much serious attention until we actually publish the draft EIS. We've had some verbal comments from them, but not much in writing. Where a revised version of the cultural resources report is going out again this summer for additional review. City staff, for example, getting a chance to review it and comment on it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner McCarter, you're on mute.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you. This might be a question for Megan. I was involved in Orange Line West segment, and so I had peripheral contact with the Tillicum Bridge design process. And I was curious, you guys have your Citizens Task Force. That process that was carried on for the Tillicum was really, I thought, really well integrated from a technical, social, community standpoint. There was really good equal representation all across that process, and was curious, do you guys have something similar in mind to, you know, when you take all these component pieces and put together a unified design for the whole thing, do you guys feel good about the process you've got set up?
So just to provide a brief overview of the process that we're setting up, we did look at the Willamette River Advisory Group. Thank you, Teresa. And this is our current approach right now. And we're just starting a type selection. So it's still open for refinement. So we are setting up what we're calling right now an Urban Design Working Group, and it could be called a different name. And the goal is to have that wide cross-section of the community represented within that group to help shape the guidelines for how this bridge should look and feel. Granted, there's certain design decisions that are happening now, just high level, what type of movable bridge, etc. But there's many more to come down the road, and so this is a long journey. Examples of folks that we anticipate reaching out to join the committee are Patty Tillett, a bridge architect or two, and then members of the architecture programs of, say, U of O or PSU, and other. We're still working on that. We're having a strategy meeting shortly. But I think the idea is to have that group inform the community task force, which then makes a recommendation. I think that's maybe the one difference between this and the Tillicum Bridge, as I understand, is we have been asking the community task force to make decisions. So I think in the Tillicum Crossing, the Willamette River Advisory Group did. So that's kind of an overview of how we're approaching the process. And we are keeping in mind making sure there's diverse representation on that urban design group. When I feel like the community task force is more a diverse group of people who are primarily located around the bridge, who are directly impacted by this project, businesses, social service providers, river users, etc. So this is an opportunity to broaden, to create a more broader group that has input on those design decisions. Let me know if I've answered your question.
No, that's great. Thank you.
You know, in general, we could kind of take turns, landmarks, and then design, but it doesn't really have to be that way. Please just go ahead and unmute so I can see you and ask away if you have another question, commissioners. And after that, Commissioner Santner. But let's take Commissioner Smith first.
Okay. I believe you had mentioned that potential impact would be to URM structures in the immediate vicinity of the bridge. I'm assuming that for the most part, those are on the west side of the bridge. Have specific properties been identified? And if so, has there been any communication with the owners of those properties? And further to that, would a consideration for mitigation be actually funding the seismic retrofit of some of those buildings that might be impacted by the bridge construction?
Okay, thank you. Yes, it's a little tricky at how to word this. What we can't do at this point is we can't dismiss the possibility of impacts to unreinforced masonry buildings that are close by. We don't think they'll be impacted. We think that there are construction techniques that can be used to avoid it, but we aren't certain about that. So we flagged it in the draft EIS as this is a concern, the potential for impacts, especially if a building is unreinforced masonry and nearby. We haven't identified any one building over another. We just, within the draft EIS, we're going to flag the buildings around the construction area that are unreinforced masonry and haven't had seismic upgrades. We're going to identify those. We also know the data on that is not entirely reliable. We're using a city database right now, and city acknowledges that they aren't sure it's entirely reliable. We've talked with at least one business or property building owner. We haven't contacted all of them yet. We feel like there's more work to do to really understand exactly how construction would occur and demolition before we can be definitive that impacts can actually be avoided, and the feasibility of some measures for mitigating it. And Steve, do you want to add any more about construction design related to that?
Yeah, I want to. So one of the things I did not say that went with this project is wherever there is bridge structure, we're going to provide a 2-foot gap between the bridge deck itself and the adjacent building. When you're on grade beyond the length of the bridge, well, then obviously we would go right up to the building face. But everywhere else, we're going to provide an offset. So that gap would help to buffer any sort of seismic demand, any pounding effects between the bridge and the building itself. So as an outcome of the project, whenever there is a building in direct proximity to the bridge, there'll be a gap. Wherever there's an entryway, we'll provide a little cantilever walkway to get out into the building itself. But beyond that, we're going to provide an offset. So that's one of the key outcomes that we think is actually a benefit for this potential risk between URMs and the structure itself. So what Jeff was getting at was the construction techniques. It's one of the reasons why the Portland Saturday Market building was a take, is because of the nature of how that building is so connected with the actual bridge itself and what we had to do. Luckily not contributing, but it's the only building that is an acquisition as part of the project itself. All the rest, we're going to be looking to minimize impacts, modify design elements, drill shafts rather than driven shafts, those kind of operations, pre-construction survey versus post-construction survey, all those kind of routine activities to help minimize the impacts through vibrations and noise and everything else. But again, the big takeaway of this is we want to provide an airspace between all buildings, URM or not, and the bridge itself.
And then you also asked, Commissioner, about would seismic retrofits be considered. At this point, we haven't listed it as a potential mitigation. We think there are less expensive ways and less drastic ways to less invasive ways that we can avoid it. But if it came to the point where, the final EIS and our analysis suggests that impacts, some kind of vibration impacts are likely to cause destruction or serious damage to those buildings, then that's a mitigation measure we'd have to look at. But at this point, we aren't suggesting it.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Sandner?
Yes, thank you. I have two questions. On your preferred option, the plan shows the location of columns on the east side and on the west side. And on the east side, it seemed like there was one row or one orange designation, and on the west side there were several. And I heard you saying that one of them would be in Waterfront Park, but close to NATO Parkway, correct?
Yes, that's correct. There's a, so speaking on the, we'll start on the west side where Waterfront Park is. The long span itself extends from the pier in the river out to that first, you know, call it row of the orange columns right adjacent to NATO Parkway. Beyond that, we're going back to conventional spans, and that's why we would have a series of additional columns. The exact column location and can we modify it to reduce one you know, set of supports, that's something that in final design can be resolved. But part of the reason why this has to happen is because the long span bridge is actually wider than the space between the buildings of the existing bridge. So we're transitioning the width from something that's wider for these long spans over the river and over the parks back down to fit between the existing buildings and minimize the right-of-way impacts. So, yep.
And then the row that is right near NATO Parkway, how many columns do you think you might need, and what are the spacing in between them?
Yeah, so right now, so this graphic is a pretty good representation of what we think would be a pretty reasonable layout for the column, for the span lengths in the columns. Mm-hmm. There are some conditions around the U of O building where there's an access doorway, and so that limits or prohibits us placing certain columns at certain locations so that they can maintain mm-hmm. access and function. Because you have the light rail system that runs along what at least we call first, but it's really the light rail corridor, right. and some structure depth clearances, you have to put some columns on either side to reduce structure depth. So there might be one set of columns where we could remove it based on vertical clearance and usability. We're sort of reserving that refinement for the final design phase. So we can make sure there's enough public outreach to say what kind of clearance is really needed underneath the bridge. But that's why there's more visible on this side. If you look to the east side, you can see a hint of an additional column. And then there's another one beyond further to the east, so just sort of outside of the view of what you can see, and then eventually the abutment. So we do have some pretty conventional shorter spans as it's transitioning back to grade. It's just these longer spans that you can really sort of focus on in this view.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, I'm gonna go ahead and jump in with another couple of questions. So first I have it's a little bit of a technical question. In the description of the long span bridge, there's two spans actually on either side of a movable piece, correct? And I guess my question really is, are both of those necessarily the same type of bridge on either side of the center portion? I mean, I think aesthetically, you know, that seems like it would make sense, but I guess my question is that necessarily true?
Yeah, you make a good point. And this question has come up from our Citizens Task Force. So the simple answer is no, they can be different structural types that are, you know, arranged based on the actual length. What we have today is an arrangement that we feel is reasonable for a consistency, but it doesn't have to be that way. That's one of those design elements that as you move into type selection and the final design that you can do a little bit of mixing and matching, and that's a place where we're sort of leaving it as one of these variables to be discussed, especially as it results to the urban design working group. What would their perspective be on having a different type? We actually did draw something up behind the scenes on having a tight arch on one and a cable stay on the other, and got very mixed reviews. But anyway, so it's to answer your question, no, it's a variable. It's subject to feedback and further study.
Okay, thank you. And then my next comment, I guess, is really regarding the previous briefing we had and historic resources. You know, I was definitely under the impression, I think many of us were, that the longer span bridge was necessarily going to be extending further into the West Side historic districts. You know, actually on both sides, you know, it would just extend further out. And I'm a little astonished perhaps to hear that there are, you know, that currently you're not thinking there are any physical impacts to existing resources in those two historic districts, partly because, you know, it's my impression that, you know, some of those buildings actually already touch the Burnside Bridge. And I do know that, for instance, the Skidmore Old Town District is a National Historic District, which supersedes even the Burnside Bridge, really, in importance. And so I know you're going to be addressing this through the Section 4F, and but it might make sense to, and I'm going to suggest that you come in front of our commission again prior to doing really any of the, you know, you said you were doing some early permitting assistance. It really would make sense to come in front of this commission to talk in a more focused way about impacts to resources. And by resources, I don't just mean, you know, individual buildings. I mean, you know, district as a whole, because that bridge is such an important piece of, you know, really two districts there on that end. And, you know, so talking about the Burnside Skate Park, I mean, that's all fine and good. And certainly, you know, at some point we could be supportive of listing it. But I think the attention really has to be on existing listed resources and making sure that, you know, the impacts there are lessened and mitigated. And so we could also talk about mitigation more, you know, your strategies for mitigation in that, you know, more focused briefing. So I wondered if you'd be amenable to that.
I think, yeah, definitely we would. One of the things you mentioned too, we've had realized that we've got a kind of a nomenclature issue that is confusing people who already know about the project. When we came to you before, I think what we probably had then was an alternative called the fixed bridge alternative, which was a long bridge, but different than what we're currently calling the long span. And that's, I know that's confusing. We're trying to figure out how we might clarify that. That fixed bridge, which was the structure itself, was much longer than any of the alternatives we have now. No movable span in the center of the river. So it had to be much higher above the river to be able to allow navigation underneath, which meant we didn't touch down until almost the park blocks.
Thank you.
That was that long bridge, fixed span or fixed bridge.
Wow.
That one was dropped. That one no longer exists.
Okay.
What we're calling the long span now is the vertical alignment, the touchdown points, the vertical clearance over the river is essentially the same as the existing bridge. Touches down in essentially the exact same spot.
Terrific. Commissioner McCarter.
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on something you said, Commissioner Miner. When I think of the family of bridges in Portland, this is, you know, this is not the most exotic and maybe the most beautiful structure in the city, but in some ways it's my favorite bridge because rather than a bunch of spaghetti of ramps spinning around as it touches down into the city, this is the one bridge and possibly the east end of the St. John's Bridge where the public realm of the urban sidewalks flanking it seamlessly flow right into the public realm of the bridge itself. You know, and things like the height of the railings along the bridge, everything from a user experience walking over it, it just feels like it's the one bridge that really connects the city on both sides of the river in a really seamless way. And almost none of our other buildings do that. They're all tangled up with freeway ramps or old clover leaves or things like that. And so, hearing that discussion about the long span, I hope that as this thing, as the new bridge evolves, that relationship of bridge deck to adjacent buildings, right as you're coming into the first group of buildings and heading towards, I believe it's 2nd Avenue is the first at-grade intersection on the west. I just hope some of those qualities that are out there in that bridge today can be in the new bridge too, because it's our best bridge in terms of city to city kind of seamless integration.
Hi, this is Commissioner Mahoney. I have a question regarding the type selection. The options that have been presented today assume the bascule type. And when it's shown as a lift type, there's additional structure that's above the bridge in addition to any support for the long spans. Does this kind of imply that you're leaning towards, or the group is leaning towards bascule? Or, you know, what do you perceive the options being for the long span support in addition to the lift type towers and all that infrastructure that's required? I'm just curious.
Sure.
How that will be impacted.
I'll take this first and then we can hand it over to Megan if you want to add something. But right now, the type of movable bridge is a question mark, whether it's a bascule similar to what's out there today, which it very well could be, or a lift type that is similar to one of the other bridges, or more similar to one of the other graphics that was in that long span fact sheet. That could be an option too. That's what the purpose of the type selection process is. It's this combination, almost like an a la carte combination of what type of fixed approach longer span goes with what type of movable span in the middle. And maybe this is a good place to zoom in at the bottom if you could, Megan, for the movable portions. There are many styles and we call it makes and models of movable bridges. So in the bascule type, this is comparable to what's out there today. And you can even see the extreme difference in look and feel between the South Park Bridge on the left, which is a very, very modern bridge that was just built in near the Seattle area, and the Harbor Bridge in Spain. Or the Woodrow Wilson Bridge that's in the far right, which has a delta pier. So it brings with it just this notion of a rotating deck rather than a lift style for any of these options below. And so these are all options on the table at this point. And the type selection phase is intended to get down to a recommendation on whether it's a bascule or a lift, and then defer into the final design exactly what type of bascule or lift once that's selected. So there's lots of variables that go with this. And we're trying to narrow down to basically, is it the bottom row or the second to bottom row in this type selection phase?
Yeah.
But they're both on the table.
I understand that, and I appreciate the explanation, but what I'm trying to get at, and I didn't probably explain it well, is that in addition to the structure that is required for the lift section versus a bascule, is in addition to structure that we would see as needed to support, so the cable stay or the tied arch, right? So then for a bridge that I'm looking at as a historic bridge that was traditionally supported from underneath the deck, that this bridge potentially could go down the path of finding itself with tremendous amounts of infrastructure on top and structure to support the entire bridge. So is that the correct assumption, that we would end up with towers on top for a lift section in addition to a tied arch or cable stay or something else, right?
That's exactly right. That is one of the options on the table.
And is that something that the urban design working group will address?
Yes, that's precisely one of the features that we would want them to help provide their guidance and input on, ultimately getting to a recommendation brought back for the Citizens Task Force to make, and then rolling up to a combination of a policy group and others to eventually land on a decision with. So that's exactly right. And maybe this is where I'll hand it over to Megan and see if, from a process standpoint, are any other questions or thoughts around that, Megan?
Yeah, it would be great if the urban design working group had a historian, architectural historian involved. But sorry, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that tip. We can definitely seek out a representative from the historic community. We do actually have Sharon and Woodman on our community task force to represent that point of view. but I like the idea of having it represented in the urban design group as well. And just a nod about process for the type selection. Just this is a 2 cents from a county owner point of view. I think we absolutely want to work with the community to find the right aesthetic features for this location in the city, basically the heart of the city. And it is a connection, kind of a human scale connection from one side of the city to the other. We want to hear comments like that. Ultimately, I think in the mix for the criteria for how we decide what structure to go with will be that seismic resiliency piece, as well as cost and schedule. Those are just things that we are finding are just rising to the top from an owner's point of view. And I think that's why we are incorporating the engineers early in the type selection phase process, because they really understand seismic resiliency, cost, constructability, and schedule.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Super quick question, and this is Commissioner Foti, super quick. Is the design team the same, or is it gonna go out to bid for the final design?
It will go out to bid. We'll be doing another RFP for the design phase in July of next year, and it's open to anybody who would like to propose.
Okay, commissioners, I'm going to pause questions for just a second so that I can ask Laura if we do have, we had somebody who wanted to testify, so I'd like to check in with that and make sure we get that person testifying as well. Laura, do you have that person checked in?
I still don't see him checked
in. Okay. Well then, great. We can carry on then. Just wanted to-
Commissioner Minor, I don't know.
Sorry, who's speaking?
I'm sorry, I'm coming in on, I'm the phone number. This is Art Graves. I've sort of gotten bumped out of the meeting. I keep getting, your internet is unstable, flashes on my computer. So
okay.
Doing the best I can. But I just wanted to throw one thing in. It was a comment that I meant to put in initially, and it kind of piggybacks, I think, somewhat nicely with Commissioner Mahoney's comment. And really, it was just a comment, and this might be getting a little bit into the minutia, but the long span option starts to, this helps when you look at the precedents that were submitted as well, I think on page 2 of the kind of the description for the long span option. And it's just kind of a, also echoing a little bit what Brian was saying, just that the, maybe if you can speak to kind of what makes this, what kind of bridge this should be, because the long span option starts to look more maybe like a regional bridge kind of typology than really like a neighborhood bridge kind of typology. And that might be you know, too much too early, but just maybe if you can add some comments just to maybe what you see this bridge being, because I think that the whole project is looking at this as a regional connector. That's, you know, that's been the conversation initially, but really this is a neighborhood bridge. It's a very important bridge in the city. So maybe trying to tease out some of those details at this point to get them in everybody's consciousness would be kind of helpful.
Thank you, Art.
Commissioner Minor, can I interject a minute? I just got a text from Kurt Kruger. It seems like the BDS website is down and you cannot connect via the link to the Zoom platform.
Yeah, this is Hillary. I was going to mention that PortlandOregon.gov is down. And so the people that are in this, are in these briefings now, they can get in. If the network comes back on, more people can come in. But people can't access the hearing through the link currently. Because scheduling both commissions together and all these agencies is difficult, and because neither commission is making a decision today, and these are only advisory briefings, we're gonna keep going and post the recordings to eFiles after this is done. But we just need to keep going. But it is a problem.
Yeah,
I think if people have comments to make, they could email them to me, Hillary, Hillary@PortlandOregon.gov, and I will forward it to both commissions while this is happening.
Okay. We should probably try to wrap this up in the next 5 minutes here. So, I guess I'm looking for, you know, any last burning kind of questions. Commissioner Livingston.
Thanks a bunch, Commissioner Minor, and big apologies to everyone from me for being late today. I had an engagement just prior to this and missed pretty much all of the presentation, but Steve and Jeff and Megan, the little bit that I saw was absolutely fantastic. And my questions for you really kind of get at an issue that Art just raised, neighborhood bridge versus regional bridge. I walk back and forth across the Burnside Bridge every single day. Even now in the era of COVID, I'm walking on the Burnside Bridge. And it is wonderful for the reasons that Commissioner McCarter outlined earlier. It is a very neighborhood pedestrian bridge, and it achieves the goals of the city's guidelines really well. It creates really good public realm on the bridge. One thing I don't understand, and this really kind of gets at placemaking, is, you know, is there any, and if this is in the materials that you presented, tell me to go study them harder, and I will. But is there any additional real estate, even just a little bit, being created underneath the new bridge? And if there is, that's fantastic. What do we do with that? If there's not, if we are just building a new bridge and then restoring or just sweeping out what is underneath the bridge and assuming that it continues as it has always been, you know, understanding that there will be changes to the skate park and, you know, other activities, this really seems like an opportunity to look at what's not going well on either end. There are some great experiences. There are also some not great experiences underneath the bridge. We could do some real legitimate placemaking as part of this bridge building exercise. And I'm wondering how much community conversation that you are planning to have is going to be looking at the ground underneath and potentially any new ground, and how we, you know, kind of take, especially what's happened at the east side of the Burnside Bridge, at all the new Burnside Bridgehead development, like Third Avenue is just fantastic. That is such a really particular spot. And, you know, being able to do more of that at both sides of the bridge, I think is really a great goal. Mm. Are we able to?
Yeah, I can respond to that. So the bridge is actually largely located on city-owned property. So our partners in this new vision of what the space under the bridge could look like include the city, parks. There's not a lot of private property that we will be getting into, but I think that is one of the goals of the Urban Design Working Group, is to start to think about the what if. So should the recommended alternative move forward and become the preferred alternative you've seen from the images today, it really opens up a lot of space in waterfront parks. So is that an opportunity that should be taken advantage? It's a delicate line we're walking as a county because we don't own that property, and, you know, we need to focus our funds on the bridge. It's expensive as it is.
Right.
So but we understand that this is a major opportunity and in a highly visible, highly active area, you know, if you consider all the events, Saturday market, et cetera. And then, as you mentioned, all that new activity on the east side. I mean, this bridge, speaking to the neighborhood quality of this bridge, this is the only bridge that has activity under it, next to it, adjoining to it. It's literally fused with the surroundings because that street was widened and cut into neighboring building faces. So yes, it is right in the middle of urban life. And so we plan to address that, but in a very practical way moving forward with our agency partners.
There is so much rich potential adjacent to this bridge. I really look forward to the conversations when you come back for the design review process, and really hope that I'm still on the commission when we have these conversations. This should be rich stuff.
Commissioner Miner, I want to make a suggestion to Megan in terms of who else to engage in the conversation when it comes to design and urban design, in particular on the west side underneath the bridge. Portland Parks Foundation and Portland Parks Board, there are members on that group that have both design skills as well as they are very strong park advocates and have quite a bit of knowledge about how those space, the waterfront has been used. So I highly, highly encourage you to engage them as well and include them as part of that group.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner. I forgot to mention that Randy Gregg has accepted to be on our
urban design. Excellent.
And he is on the board. So thank you for that point.
Okay, I think we need to call this briefing short today, and thank you so much to Megan and Jeff and Steve. It was really informative, and I look forward to getting into some of the nitty-gritty details with you at another time, hopefully not too far in the future. Commissioners, we expect to restart again here at 3:15, so I'm going to go ahead and turn off my camera, see you all back here.